The children took the cows and goats out to graze and brought them in at night before the wolves and bears came prowling. Since Neolithic man had the bow, he probably also had stringed instruments, for the rhythmic twanging of a bowstring seems almost inevitably to lead to that. He also had earthenware drums, across which skins were stretched. Perhaps also he made drums by stretching skins over hollow tree stems. We don't know when man began to sing, but evidently he was making music, and since he had words, songs were no doubt being made. To begin with, perhaps he just let his voice loose as one may hear Italian peasants now, behind their ploughs, singing songs without words. After dark, in the winter, he sat in his house and talked and sang and made implements by touch rather than sight. His lighting must have been poor, and chiefly firelight, but there was probably always some fire in the village, summer or winter. Fire was too troublesome to make for men to be willing to let it out readily. Sometimes a great disaster happened to those pile villages. The fire got free, and they were burnt out. The Swiss deposits contain clear evidence of such catastrophes. All this we gather from the remains of the Swiss pile dwellings, and such was the character of the human life that spread over Europe, coming from the south and from the east, with the forests as 10,000 or 12,000 years ago, the reindeer and the reindeer men passed away. It's evident that we have here a way of life already separated by a great gap of thousands of years of invention from its original Paleolithic stage. The steps by which it rose from that condition we can only guess at. From being a hunter hovering upon the outskirts of flocks and herds of wild cattle and sheep, and from being a co-hunter with the dog, man by insensible degrees may have developed a sense of proprietorship in the beasts, and struck up a friendship with his canine competitor. He learned to turn the cattle when they wandered too far. He brought his better brain to bear to guide them to fresh pasture. He hemmed the beasts into valleys and enclosures where he could be sure to find them again. He fed them when they were starved, and so slowly he tamed them. Perhaps his agriculture began with the storage of fodder. He reaped, no doubt, before he sowed. The Paleolithic ancestor, away in that unknown land of origin to the southeast, first supplemented the precarious meat supply of the hunter by eating roots and fruits and wild grains. Man storing graminiferous grasses for his cattle might easily come to beat out the grain for himself. Fourth, all these early beginnings must have taken place far back in time and in regions of the world that have still to be effectively explored by the archaeologists. They were probably going on in Asia, Africa, in what's now the bed of the Mediterranean, or in the region of the Indian Ocean, while the reindeer man was developing his art in Europe. The Neolithic men who drifted over Europe and Western Asia 12,000 or 10,000 years ago were long past these beginnings. They were already close, a few thousand years, to the dawn of written tradition and the remembered history of mankind. Without any very great shock or break, bronze came at last into human life, giving a great advantage in warfare to those tribes who first obtained it. Written history had already begun before weapons of iron came into Europe to supersede bronze. Already in those days a sort of primitive trade had sprung up. Bronze and bronze weapons, and such rare and hard stones as jade, gold because of its plastic and ornamental possibilities, and skins and flax net and cloth were being swapped and stolen and passed from hand to hand over great stretches of country. Salt also was probably being traded. On a meat dietary, men can live without salt, but grain-consuming people need it just as herbivorous animals need it. Hoff says that bitter tribal wars have been carried on by the desert tribes of the Sudan in recent years, for the possession of the salt deposits between Fezzan and Murzuk. To begin with, barter, blackmail, tribute, and robbery by violence passed into each other by insensible degrees. Men got what they wanted by such means as they could. Fifth, So far, we've been telling of a history without events, a history of ages and periods and stages in development. But before we conclude this portion of the human story, we must record what was probably an event of primary importance, and at first perhaps of tragic importance to developing mankind, and that was the breaking in of the Atlantic waters to the great Mediterranean Valley. The reader must keep in mind that we're endeavouring to give him plain statements that he can take hold of comfortably. But both in the matter of our time charts and the three maps we've given of prehistoric geography, there's necessarily much speculative matter. We've dated the last glacial age and the appearance of the true men as about 40,000 or 35,000 years ago. Please bear that about in mind. The truth may be 60,000 or 20,000, but it's no good saying a very long time or ages ago, because then the reader won't know whether we mean centuries or millions of years. And similarly, in these maps we give, they represent not the truth, but something like the truth. The outline of the land was some such outline. There were such seas and such land masses. But both Mr. Horobin, who's drawn these maps, and I, who've incited him to do so, have preferred to err on the timid side. We're not geologists enough to launch out into original research in these matters, and so we've stuck to the 40-fathom line and the recent deposits as our guides for our post-glacial map and for the map of 12,000 to 10,000 BC. But in one matter, we have gone beyond these guides. It's practically certain that at the end of the last glacial age, the Mediterranean was a couple of landlocked sea basins, not connected, or only connected by a torrential overflow river. The eastern basin was the fresher. It was fed by the Nile, the Adriatic River, the Red Sea River, and perhaps by a river that poured down amidst the mountains that are now the Greek archipelago, from the very much bigger sea of Central Asia that then existed. Almost certainly, human beings and possibly even Neolithic men wandered over that now lost Mediterranean valley. The reasons for believing this are very good and plain. To this day, the Mediterranean is a sea of evaporation. The rivers that flow into it don't make up for the evaporation from its surface. There's a constant current of water pouring into the Mediterranean from the Atlantic, and another current streaming in from the Bosporus and Black Sea. For the Black Sea gets more water than it needs from the big rivers that flow into it. It's an overflowing sea, while the Mediterranean is a thirsty sea. From which it must be plain that when the Mediterranean was cut off both from the Atlantic Ocean and the Black Sea, it must have been a shrinking sea, and its waters sinking to a much lower level than those of the ocean outside. This is the case of the Caspian Sea today. Still more so is it the case with the Dead Sea. But if this reasoning is sound, then where today roll the blue waters of the Mediterranean, there must once have been great areas of land, and land with a very agreeable climate. This was probably the case during the last glacial age, and we don't know how near it was to our time when the change occurred that brought back the ocean waters into the Mediterranean basin. Certainly there must have been Grimaldi people, and perhaps even Azilian, a Neolithic people, going about in the valleys and forests of these regions that are now submerged. The Neolithic dark whites, the people of the Mediterranean race, may have gone far towards the beginnings of settlement and civilization in that great lost Mediterranean valley. Mr. W. B. Wright gives us some very stimulating suggestions here. He suggests that in the Mediterranean basin there were two lakes, one a freshwater lake in the eastern depression which drained into the other in the western depression. It's interesting to think what must have happened when the ocean level rose once more as a result of the dissipation of the ice sheets and its waters began to pour over into the Mediterranean area. The inflow, small at first, must have ultimately increased to enormous dimensions as the channel was slowly lowered by erosion and the ocean level slowly rose. If there were any unconsolidated materials on the sill of the strait, The result must have been a genuine debacle, and if we consider the length of time which even an enormous torrent would take to fill such a basin as that of the Mediterranean, we must conclude that this result was likely to have been attained in any case. Now this may seem all the wildest speculation, but it isn't entirely so, for if we examine a submarine contour map of the Straits of Gibraltar, we find there is an enormous valley running up from the Mediterranean deep, right through the straits, and trenching some distance out on to the Atlantic shelf. This valley or gorge is probably the work of the inflowing waters of the ocean at the termination of the period of interior drainage. This refilling of the Mediterranean, which by the rough chronology we're employing in this book may have happened somewhere between 30,000 and 10,000 BC, must have been one of the greatest single events in the prehistory of our race. If the later date is the truer, then, as the reader will see plainly enough after reading the next two chapters, the crude beginnings of civilization, the first lake dwellings and the first cultivation, were probably round that eastern Levantine lake, into which there flowed not only the Nile, but the two great rivers that are now the Adriatic and the Red Sea. Suddenly, the ocean waters began to break through over the westward hills and to pour in upon these primitive peoples. The lake that had been their home and friend became their enemy. Its waters rose and never abated. Their settlements were submerged. The waters pursued them in their flight. Day by day and year by year, the waters spread up the valleys and drove mankind before them. Many must have been surrounded and caught by the continually rising salt flood. It knew no check. It came faster and faster. It rose over the treetops, over the hills, until it had filled the whole basin of the present Mediterranean, and until it lapped the mountain cliffs of Arabia and Africa. Far away, long before the dawn of history, this catastrophe occurred.